funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to create a crime novel that is as page-turningly compelling as it is scientifically accurate? Author Patricia Cornwell is the ideal person to ask about this, and she has done it 19 times now with her New York Times bestselling Scarpetta series alone. Her latest offering, Red Mist, takes Chief Medical Examiner Dr. Kay Scarpetta out of her comfort zone of power and high-tech field in lab science and into a nearly decade-old murder mystery with huge repercussions on Kay's own personal and professional life. Patricia Cornwell is in town for a signing event tonight at 7 at the Barnes & Noble Lincoln Park store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. We are delighted she could make time for us this afternoon. Patricia, welcome to Think.
Thank you. And that was such a great description of the book. You said it better than I could.
Well, thank you. Well, you wrote it, so I went from there. This is kind of an emotional journey for Kay in some ways. She's still sort of healing from the death of a colleague and also an attempt on her own life. And she's out of her comfort zone sort of geographically.
Yes. And it's also... Both Port Mortuary, the last book, and now Red Mist have also caused her to really have to reflect over her whole career mm-hmm. because she's had to think about things that happened even before her first job when she started out in Virginia in the very late 80s or around 1990. And she has to kind of look at herself a little bit, and she has some ambivalence about some decisions she's made. She, for example, her mentoring of this Jack Fielding, which is such a big part of this book, she has to really reflect on why does she hold on to people who actually do her harm? Mm-hmm. Why doesn't she let them go? And so it's a very psychological book, which is one of the reasons I chose this very gothic Old South terrain of the Low Country of Georgia, where she ends up in an old cargo van headed to a prison, and she never leaves.
It's interesting, too, because she's very human in that part of her reflecting back on her career is being really bothered by the fact that people she thought had only really good opinions of her have said things that have hurt her feelings, which is maybe not something that you expect from this superhero medical examiner, and yet really real.
Yeah, it's devastating to her. I mean, one of the reasons that her husband, Benton Wesley, who's the FBI agent, did not want her to go down to Savannah to talk to this woman in prison is not so much that he thought she was going to be reeled into some sort of conspiracy that's a legal conspiracy and even a potentially deadly conspiracy, is he's more worried about what's going to do to her mentally, because he really believes this woman's going to be abusive to her once she gets her in her clutches. Mm-hmm. You know, she's sitting across the table from this woman who sexually abused this man who was her deputy chief, you know, when he was a boy. And terrible repercussions from all that, kind of an irony with everything that's been in the news of late about that sort of thing. But Benton doesn't want her going because he knows this is going to be bad. And sure enough, once this lady, this horrible creature in prison, because she really is a rather vile person, mm-hmm. starts telling her very hurtful things about things that Jack said about Scarpetta when he used to work for her. In the very beginning, when he was one of her fellows, you know, devastatingly rude, crude comments. Now, you don't really know if they're true or not. Mm-hmm. Did he really say that in letters that he wrote to this woman in prison? Or is she making it up just to be cruel? And you never really know the answer to that. But it is a very huge moment for Scarpetta when she's confronted with this, and she's devastated by it. And then she becomes obsessed with knowing, are these letters real? Have other people read them and not told me about them?
She now, this is the first book that I have read in this series, but she strikes me as a character who never, despite what caring friends and relatives and other people suggest to her, she's going to do, Kay Scarpetta is going to do what she's going to do.
She is relentless that way, and it gets her into trouble, but it's also what saves the day. Because, for example, in Red Mist, you have these really weird cases that are happening right before her eyes, deaths that nobody can figure out why these people are dying, but you know something really bad is happening. And, of course, there's a bit of a shocker in the book in terms of – and I won't say anything more than that. But her focus is also on these 9-year-old homicides, a family that was murdered, and this person who's about to be executed for these crimes. And Scarpetta is taking a look at the evidence while she's down there, and she goes, whoa, this is the wrong story. Mm-hmm. Something else happened here. And she refuses to let it go, even though nobody else cares about these cases anymore. But because she doesn't let it go, she actually ends up resolving the bigger thing that's going on, because that's who she is. She works what's in front of her, and she doesn't quit because every life is important to her.
So when you started with this series, did you recognize that it would be as much a series of stories about Kay Scarpetta and the people she's friends with as it would be just sort of the murder of the week?
No, you know, the truth of the matter is, I'll be honest, shows like CSI have forced me in a slightly different direction. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started out, I ruled the day in terms of writing about forensics. There was no other show in town. The Scarpetta series created what essentially is the forensic entertainment industry. And
that's a funny term, by the way, the forensic entertainment
industry. But
it's
huge, and it's not only television, movies, and books. It's also even in the supplies that are sold to police. Hmm. All you've got to do is Google it. There's every fancy kind of fingerprint powder brush and luminescent this and that and the latest chemical or reagent. It's a tremendous industry. And so what in the 90s, what I could do is I go, oh, okay, so I'm going to do a book. Oh, I know what. I'll show you about trace evidence. Mm-hmm. Oh, I know what. I'll show you about forensic fire investigation. Or I'll have Scarpetta recover a body from water, so I'll show you scuba diving. Whatever it was, nobody else was doing it. And then one day this is a true story. My friend Billie Jean King, you know, the tennis player, mm-hmm. my idol when I was a kid, she says, hey, have you seen this show CSI? I said, what? No, I don't watch shows on TV like that or crime stuff. And she said, well, you better take a look at it. It's really quite amazing. And they became, you know, these shows, these procedural shows just took over. And it was no longer, if I'm going to show you a scanning electron microscope, 20 pages of it, and do it with pristine accuracy, that's no longer enough anymore. Mm-hmm. Because you can watch that. You can see, and furthermore, you can see stuff that's science fiction. It's not even real. I can't do that. So yeah. I can't compete with it because I'm not going to make up a magic box. What I show you is real. So the last few years in particular, I have focused a lot more on being a really good storyteller, being very descriptive about the atmosphere of where it's all taking place and really getting into these characters and the relationships. You still have all the forensic science and medicine, and I still show you the newest thing before anybody else, but I no longer make the story about that. That's just part of it because actually I think the books are better now because I'm doing that.
You mentioned the setting here is the Gothic Deep South in this creepy old, not so creepy old, but this women's prison. How much is place a character in your stories, and how does that sort of play into the tone of what you'll do?
That's a very good question, and that's exactly what I'm getting to. Is I'm trying to develop place as more of a character mm-hmm. because I do think it's a character, and I think that in the earlier, starting about 2003. When I wrote Blowfly, and it was followed by Trace and then Predator and then Book of the Dead. There's a four-book series there where I sort of lost having a place. Mm-hmm. And Scarpetta was all over the place. She was in Florida and running around here and there, and it didn't work very well. I mean, I regret it. She needs to be someplace where place is a character, not just something she's inhabiting geographically. So now she has a headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so that part of the world will be an evolving character. Savannah, I'm very familiar with that part of the world, and it's definitely a character in this book. And I've spent time there. I've been to the medical examiner's office there. I know the guy who runs the place. And I wanted you to see that Spanish moss. I wanted you to hear the rain falling. I wanted you to feel how hot she was when it's 100 degrees outside in the summer and to be in that unair-conditioned vehicle she's in and to smell Merino sweat. You know, mm-hmm. I wanted to make it very vivid.
I want to talk about your research because you are famous for you've spent lots of time with people who do this work professionally. At this stage in your career, I would imagine they are intimidated to have you come in, thinking that they have nothing to teach you and you know it all.
No. As a matter of fact, it's harder. It's a lot of these places don't want people coming in. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be when I started out, it was like, well, yeah, sure, you can come in here. I mean, nobody else is interested, but I mean, I could. Nobody was visiting morgues and laboratories when I started doing it. Now every show producer in town wants to go to places. In fact, they want to film their shows there, mm-hmm. you know, like Dr. G down in Orlando. So it's, you know, so some of these places actually are quite protective. I have to really earn my keep and be I'm very fortunate when places let me come in and explore what they do because – a lot of chief medical examiners are very sensitive about the entertainment factor of all this, and they don't want to violate the dignity of not only their work but, of course, their patients. So what I have to do is prove myself. not as an author, but it's like, you know, remember, I've seen thousands of these cases. I'm a huge respecter of it. I don't come in here and do anything that's inappropriate. And once they trust me, then it's a really great thing. So it's not exactly what people might think.
You mentioned the fact that you have been to these places and visited. I wonder how different they are from department to department. I mean, and how you kind of decide which way Kay's going to go.
Oh, very different. I mean, it can be anything from a coroner's office in London that doesn't even have an X-ray machine, you know, that's like a 200-year-old building. To where I most recently was, the chief medical examiner's office in Maryland, which is set in Baltimore, where they're doing – what's the most space-age facility I've ever seen. It's brand new, and they're doing virtual autopsies there. They have got the CT scanner, just like I described in Port Mortuary. And, I mean, unbelievable the technology these people have. So the range is just almost endless. And it goes from being extremely primitive to being extremely high-tech.
Why wouldn't you show a magic box when a lot of people who come to these books wouldn't necessarily know the difference, although now certainly they're more sophisticated than maybe they were 20 years ago. But why does it matter so much?
Because I don't need to. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, Scarpetta can use a knitting needle as a bullet probe. And, mm-hmm. and what you're interested in is what she's looking for and why. You know, I always say if – you know, I would watch – this sounds goofy because it's my made-up character, right? But I would watch her do anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, if she were real, there's nothing I'd like better than to watch her looking at bloody clothing and see that mind of hers working and say, what are you thinking right now? Because she's piecing things together, da-da-da-da-da, doing this the way her thoughts are going in a way that nobody else's do. And that's what's fun for me when I'm writing the books is to actually physically – it's like I'm in the room with her and I watch her picking up something and looking at it and I go – and then I see what she's thinking. And I go, wow, this is so cool. And it's like she's doing it, not me.
Yeah, that's remarkable because her mind obviously comes from your mind, but you feel detached from it in a way?
I feel a little detached from it because that character brings out something in me that I don't usually have in my normal walk in life. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, it's me thinking these things, but I'm projecting them onto her. And it's really more like she's thinking them because but I know, I mean, I know literally it's me doing it. And actually, I'm that way myself. I mean, everything I look at has possibilities. I'm looking at this blank piece of paper in front of me and I'm thinking I want to draw a cartoon on it right now. You know, I'm just a very creative person. And so that – but it's better for me to separate myself from those characters and project these things onto them as if they're doing it. So I'm almost reporting on them. If I get myself in the way, then it makes me self-conscious and I'm frankly bored.
Some of the things that Kay can do and that we see on some of these other shows feel like magic to those of us who don't really know how it all works. Was there a point for you at which it became sort of demystified so you would only see it through the eyes of almost like an investigator?
Well, it is sort of demystified. I mean, the technology is technology and quite frankly – oh, here's the shocking thing I'm going to say. I find technology is boring. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about technology is what people do with it. And so you can have a scanning electron microscope. You can have an alternate light source. You can have a reagent that might make invisible blood light up so you can see it. All of that is just stuff. It's just a weird-looking machines. It's bottles of things. But if you put it in the hands of a really interesting person, now that technology becomes – it's alive. And it's fascinating.
My guest is novelist Patricia Cornwell. Her newest book in the Kay Scarpetta series is called Red Mist. She's in town for a signing event this evening at 7 at the Barnes & Noble at 7700 West Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you would like to join our conversation, we have telephone lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Patricia Cornwell. Her latest book is called Red Mist. She's in town for a signing event this evening at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Patricia, I imagine if anybody has a theory about this, it is you. Why are we entertained by stories of the thing we dread most in the world and can't even look at if it's real, but can't get enough of if it's not?
Because it's a way we feel if we can get a little closer to what we fear, then maybe we won't be so afraid of it and maybe we'll understand it. And it's a little bit like going to the zoo or the aquarium, and the first thing you want to see is the tiger or the shark, because there's a safe barrier between mm-hmm. you and it. And so you can look that shark right in its dead-looking eyes and go and find certain solace in it, whereas if you were swimming in it, you'd be terrified. And so we want to get close to the things we fear. I think it's a little bit of a delusion on our part that if we understand what we fear, it will go away. And, of course, it won't. Death is never going to go away. We never know if any of us are going to be the victims of violence, whether it's an automobile accident or something far worse. But yet, thankfully, we're able to put that on a shelf, because none of us could put one foot in front of the other every morning if we really had that staring us in the face and felt it at the back of our neck every minute that we exist. It's better that we really don't, but subconsciously we feel compelled to try to understand it. And I think one of the reasons Scarpetta has been so successful is that she almost holds your hand on that pilgrimage. She walks you through the valley of death, mm-hmm. but you feel safe because you're with her. And I think that's one of the reasons there was such a hue and cry when I switched to the third person point of view back in 2003, which of course I've switched back from that now, is because my fans didn't feel as safe anymore when they were walking through a book and suddenly she was no longer in the room with them.
Do you think they were afraid maybe she wasn't immortal?
I think that what she sees and what I showed to them was too painful. Mm-hmm. When she's with you, it's okay. But when she's not, and I didn't like it either, because particularly in scenes where I had to take on the persona of the killer,
yeah,
that was really uncomfortable for me. I sometimes almost couldn't stand it. And I did it for three books. It sort of started tapering off. And then when I wrote Scarpetta and the Scarpetta Factor, which again was third person point of view, I did not take the killer's perspective in those. And then I switched to Port Mortuary, I went back to first person point of view, and I realized I'm really happier there too. I like it better when she's around.
And yet you have to get inside the minds of these killers in order to create crimes and crime scenes that ring true to people.
That's true, but it's somehow different when you're writing it and showing them doing what they do. And it's very similar to my own experiences with my research. The thing that I actually just could not deal with all these years that I've done this is when I would get with people like forensic psychiatrists or profilers, and they would show me videotapes or audio, or have me listen to audio tapes that some of these serial killers had taken and recorded of things that they were doing, and I had to sort of witness it. And it was, while people were still alive. And that was the worst thing I've ever had to experience. And it's a little bit like that if I'm writing it and I'm in the mind of that person as he's doing it in my book. It's too painful. Mm-hmm. I don't like it, so I just refuse to go there anymore.
You mentioned psychiatrists and trying to understand these crimes. I mean, there's the question of serial killers. Are they mentally ill? Are they just evil? Is it possible to be both or neither?
I think that it's a mixture of things. I think people can be born with proclivities because of just their DNA wiring, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And then you take their experiences in childhood and things that are done to them or with them. And all of that creates an alchemy that might result in a monster. And then again, but it's very mysterious, because you can have somebody go through something very similar and they actually turn out the opposite. They're extra good mm-hmm. because somehow it creates empathy in them as opposed to a sociopathy where they feel nothing for anyone. So it's very mysterious. But and I also believe some of it can't be undone. I'm sorry to say that I think there's some types of people that no matter what you do with them, they're not going to change, and you just have to protect society from them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phones to Amy in Michigan. Hi, Amy.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please, Amy.
Hi. I just wanted to ask Patricia what it is that she finds most rewarding and can take to benefit her writing from these meetings with the fans on the road?
Well, I love meeting the fans on the road. All of, and I'll include you in the mix if you're one of them. You're lots of fun. And it really gives me tremendous pleasure to think that maybe I create something that means something to people, that it's not even just entertaining, that these characters almost become part of their family. That's hugely gratifying.
We were talking a little bit before the show started about you keeping up with the developments that have happened over the years, because everything, I guess most of these books are still available in paperback. In print, correct?
All of them, yes.
Okay, so you meet somebody on a plane who is reading book three. What kind of conversation can you have with them?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, probably not always a real good one, because if you're reading one of my early books, there's chances are you're seeing a name of a character or reading about something that I may not remember, believe it or not, particularly minor characters that walk on and off a stage in one of the books. So I keep electronic versions of all the books. It's a database so that I can research certain things, or my editor can research something. Like I'll say, when's the last time I mentioned Janet in one of my books? And what was the disposition of that? Where is she? Do I know where she is now? What did I say back then? Because it might have been 10 books ago. And then that gives me an option of what I might want to do many, many books later. Do I want to bring this person back? I'm actually doing that right now. I had to research what happened to a certain character. I won't say who it is. And because there's going to be some development in my 20th about this particular person. So it's just not possible to remember everything. I can't possibly do it. I mean, postmortem I wrote 22, 23 years ago.
Did you think that you would be as interested in these characters as you are today when you began?
You know, I actually know, because I remember when I was writing The Last Precinct, which came out in 2000. I hate to admit this, but I was starting to get slightly bored with everybody. And that's why I decided to switch to the third person point of view. So I suppose that was good, because it recharged my batteries a little bit, even though a lot of the fans don't like that point of view. But now I don't know what's happened. I'm more interested in them than I ever was. I think it's because the world has changed so dramatically that you almost want to have coffee with them and say, what do you think of all this? I mean, do you do Twitter? Do you do Facebook? And Scarpetta would say, I get news feeds off of Twitter. And Marino would say, yeah, I do it. I just met somebody. And then now, you know, trouble's about to happen. So it's I just get endless ideas because the world is moving at such a fast pace.
It's funny, too, to hear you describe it, you know, having been bored and now you're back to it. It's almost like a relationship.
It is
a
relationship.
You fall in love, then you have this ennui, and then you fall back in love.
Writing is a relationship to me. It's not work, even though it's hard and it's relentless. It's a relationship. When I sit in that chair, it almost feels like a cockpit, and you're getting all the systems fired up, and you're hoping someone's in the seat next to you so that you can move the story forward. And sometimes there's not, and you have to get up and go do something else. And then sometimes it's like you're having a really good relationship with those characters, and you say, let's go work this crime scene. And it's also with just the craft of it, because you have to have feelings about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have a passion for this, you shouldn't be doing it. It's really a labor of love.
What do you assume about the people who read these books and the people who wait, you know, at the bookstore before it opens on the morning it's going to be there?
I assume a number of things. I assume my readers are intelligent, because you really have to be to read the Scarpetta series, because it's not thin soup.
Right.
I assume that my readers are very, very demanding, and they don't want to be disappointed when they pick up the next book, that they're going to be really upset if they don't like what you've done. And that's going to happen sometimes. And boy, they let me know.
Good and bad, they let you know.
Yeah, they let me know. And I assume that they want to spend those 400 or 500 pages with these characters, because they have a relationship with them too.
Mm-hmm. Do you think about length? Do you think, okay, people want a certain number of hours of enjoyment out of each book?
It's a really weird thing. My books almost always are the same length, no matter what. I mean, they always range, you know, between about 460 and maybe 520 pages, somewhere around in there. It's like that. My tape runs out. That's how it can't go any longer, and I can't tell the story in any fewer pages. I couldn't possibly write a 300-page Scarpetta book. My agent once said, because the deadlines are always looming, she says, you know, they don't have to be that long. Write it shorter. And it's like, I can't. I can't. How do you do that?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have one here from Steve in Dallas who says, it's obvious you love what you do and are successful in this genre. Have you ever considered crossing over to something like science fiction?
No, I don't think I'd really want to write science fiction. I really like writing what I write, and there's so many possibilities with what I can do with it. Forensic science and medicine and the criminal justice system. For example, the Supreme Court just ruled a couple of years ago, I believe, I'm not sure exactly when it was, that, for example, Scarpetta could generate an autopsy report. Mm-hmm. And that would be a standalone document in court. She didn't necessarily have to be subpoenaed to appear. Sometimes you would stipulate that the report was enough because it wasn't that big a deal, whatever it said. Mm-hmm. Now the defendant has a right to demand to face his so-called accuser.
For cross-examination.
Right. Mm-hmm. So what's happening these days is that these people are in court all the time now because some of it's just harassment. And so when I found out about this, I said, oh, I love it. I love it because Scarpetta is going to have somebody who's going to make her be there because mm-hmm. some weird bad person has a fixation and wants to look her in the face. So things are always changing. And so I continue to be excited about it. So I don't want to write anything else.
Do you always like her?
Yeah, I do always like her. I mean, she may not always do things that are appealing. She can be a little bit standoffish. I think if you met her at a cocktail party, it might take a minute for you to warm up to her because mm-hmm. you wouldn't know how to read her.
Yeah.
But I know that inside she's a really decent person and that she's not unkind to people. Mm-hmm. That's the big thing because I can't stand unkindness. I think I just really have a loathing for people who belittle others and are unkind, whether it's through jealousy or pettiness or whatever it is. And that's the one thing I will not let her be. So that's why I still like her.
Another theme that I found in this book and also read appears in the others is food. And it means a lot more to Kay than just filling up three times a day when you're hungry. Can you talk about that?
Well, Scarpetta has a tiny problem with being demonstrative with people. I mean, she's not a big hugger. She doesn't run up and, oh, hey, howdy, honey, how are you, like I do in North Carolina.
If but, you're from a certain
yeah,
point under
I know.
The Mason-Dixon line.
I was listening to Texas Drawl and I'm right at home. But food is a way that she can really give herself to people. Mm-hmm. I mean, if she and Marino have to have a really serious talk and they're not – maybe things are a little dicey with them, which is not infrequent, she would have him over and make him a meal. And that – the act of her using her hands to prepare something for him is actually her way of saying it's okay, mm-hmm. you know, where the circle is unbroken.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ron in Plano. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good afternoon. Patricia, you've got your readers pegged. And your books are not repetitive so far. I've enjoyed all of them.
Thank you.
I only want to say that it's a little bit scary. How do you come up with all these different topics?
Well, all you have to do is know what's going on in the world. You know, when I visit medical examiner's offices or hang out with the police or the FBI or whatever, you know, I hear stories that are so – some of them so bizarre I couldn't even use them in a book. And, for example, in Red Mist – and I won't say what the weapon is, but the thing that's the weapon in this book, I got the idea from talking to the military. I said – I went and sat down with some Navy doctors and said, tell me what you fear. What are you afraid of out there? What could be weaponized that we should all be worried about? And so it's I really get my ideas by still being that roving journalist and going around and it requires that I spend time with the real people, and that has been my greatest blessing, I think, because the other side effect of that is I'm very comfortable with fans because I've never put myself in some precious category that I'm too good to associate with people because I'm successful. I associate with people all the time. I have to from my work. I'm still a reporter. Mm-hmm. So I'm very – that. So I sort of the same person I ever was, if that makes any sense.
So you started writing – was it North Carolina?
Well, you know, I wrote my first – actually, yes, because I wrote my first novel when I was in college in North Carolina, mm-hmm. and it was a really terrible novel. And then I –
You got that one out of the way to move
well,
on
Well, I had
stuff.
To write four bad novels before I wrote a good one. And and then I went to the Charlotte Observer. Mm-hmm. And that's where I started out in journalism, and I got – they gave me the crime beat. Much to my dismay, I wanted to write features.
Really?
I wanted to write pretty stories, and mm-hmm. what are you giving me this horrible thing for? And I got totally addicted to the crime beat. And I was really a frustrated investigator. I was always running around with the police like I was going to solve the crime. And one of my great days was when I found out I was being subpoenaed because I'd written a series on prostitution, and I was being subpoenaed because a prostitute had admitted too much stuff to me. And I was really excited about having to testify in court, and my editor said, "You shouldn't be excited about things like this. You don't want to get involved like this." I said, "Yeah, I do."
Mm-hmm. Did you did you find yourself unable to sort of detach from the cases you were covering?
No, I would really get very involved in them. I would mm-hmm. ride with the police. We'd talk about them. And it really fed my creativity because, you know, they drive me past a house and the windows, the lights are all out because that person was murdered. Mm-hmm. And they talk about it. You know, it's, again, absorbing because you spend time. And even though I was writing nonfiction stories, that became the texture of them because of these descriptive things that made these stories emotional. Or if it's a little girl who was abducted and whose body was found on a lakeshore, I would go there and explore that area. And then I'd go to the house and talk to the family and see her bedroom. And it's really sad to talk about, but I wanted to absorb it because I really wanted people to feel what they should feel about it.
The other thing that a lot of police have to deal with this, and I would imagine medical examiners as well, outside of the earshot of anyone who could be hurt by it, there's that tremendous sense of gallows humor. And I'm wondering if that was something that you had to sort of learn to manage appropriately early on when you first experienced it.
There's a lot of that. I don't have it. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just a prude, but I won't do it. And the really good medical examiners I deal with don't. They have a body sense of humor, but what they never at the expense of, quote, their patients.
They don't forget it's a person.
Yeah, and I don't either. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not going to go in there and ever make a crack about somebody because that's someone's mother, someone's father, it's someone's partner. And so you will never hear me making funny asides about people who have been victims of something awful.
Patricia Cornwell is my guest. Her newest novel is called Red Mist. She will be signing copies this evening at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. That starts at 7. If you'd like to join our conversation, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist Patricia Cornwell, creator of the Scarpetta series of novels. Her latest is called Red Mist, and she's in town for a signing this evening at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. It starts at 7. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Patricia, when you write a book, I mean, you work with an editor and things like that, but you are in control from word one to the very last word. When you hand something like this off to a filmmaker, you don't have very much control at all.
Well, you know, that's exactly right, and that's been a really big fear of mine all these years. I mean, the Scarpetta series has been in one option or another since 1990, and as a lot of people know, there's never been a movie made, and it's always been because the screenplay failed. Nobody has ever written a good script, including me. I've tried a number of them, and I'm just not a screenwriter. And I think I'm way too close to the material to do mm-hmm. it anyway. But that's been the big risk. One of the reasons I would not sell Scarpetta to television is I didn't want her trivialized, mm-hmm. and I didn't want her being some ass-kicking smart mouth chick, you know what I mean?
That's yeah, not like the Charlie's Angels in tight jeans kind of.
Yeah, just I wanted, you know, and I thought my fans would be really upset if that happened to her, and I would be really upset. But what's the good news is, I mean, we've got a really great screenwriter for the film project that I'm involved in now, and it's I can tell you that this character is not being trivialized, and she doesn't do anything that I think is a breach of what she of her character. It's going to be an original story. It's not based on any of my books. A real thriller, really. But that's a big relief. Now, I can't guarantee what's going to happen before it's all over with because it hasn't been filmed yet, or if there are other ones down the road. But that was my biggest fear, not so much that something wouldn't adhere to one of my books or anything, or even that some of the technology might be just a little bit fudged. I was worried about ruining her and turning her into something like you were talking about a minute ago. I don't want whoever plays Scarpetta to be making some crack about a dead body. You know, these morbid, silly things that people say that would be extremely offensive if the wrong person heard it. It's just my fans, when they've met me, know that I love to laugh and we have a lot of fun. But there's some things that aren't funny.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mineral Wells and speak with Tess. Hello, Tess.
Hi. I am so thrilled to be able to be a part of your program here.
Welcome.
I wanted to ask if I had read several of your Scarpetta things, and I really love them. They're really great. But you also wrote one about your theory about Jack the Ripper, which I just totally got into.
This is nonfiction.
And, yes.
Yeah. And the character that you alluded to being the killer, you know, I think in Richard...
Walter Sickert.
Oh, Walter. Okay. Well, and then in the book, you had made reference to his father, mm-hmm. I believe, being either a painter, and my hand is wrong, of course, being a painter or an actor.
Sickert's father was the illustrator for Punch magazine, for Punch and Judy, I mean, which is really weird because if you know Punch and Judy, you know, there's a little like puppet-like characters, and one of them's always hitting somebody with a stick type thing. And on a number of the Jack the Ripper letters that he wrote to the police and the media, there's little doodles of Punch and Judy, you know, of some little cartoon character hitting another with a stick, cartoon sort of violence, which I mentioned in the book because it's although that doesn't prove somebody's a killer, it's just part of the composite of this portrait of this person that begins to emerge when you really start looking into the actual case.
What an interesting era for you to take on as a nonfiction project, because the most basic technology that we have available to us today wasn't around back then.
Oh, it's such a shame. It's such a shame. There, even though they could have done some of the things needed to do that would have been helpful in working that case, because they did have microscopes, obviously. Hospitals could tell the difference between human and animal blood, but police weren't – there was no police science back then in the Victorian era when the Ripper crimes began. So they really couldn't – the cops couldn't tell the difference between animal and human blood. And when they would take the clothing off the victim, they just threw it out in the alleyway.
So crime scene totally disturbed. They haven't taken a photograph or a sketch or anything.
The only photographs they took – were in the actual mortuary, where they would actually put the victim in a wooden coffin and stand it up against the wall because they had a wooden box camera that could only shoot straight on. And so they were basically propped up.
Wow.
And the only crime scene photograph that we know of were two that were taken of Mary Kelly in her house, because – or in the apartment that she rented, because the other victims were killed outdoors. The ones that have been confirmed as Ripper victims, I think he killed more than just five people. But so there was like an alleyway or a city square in the fog at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. But Mary Kelly's crime scene, I know if somebody could have gone in there and worked it the way we work it today, we would know for a fact who committed that crime. I'm sure he left pieces and parts of himself all over the place, including because I used alternate light sources on some of Sickert's paintings, you know, non-destructive way of looking. And some things like tempera paint, it lights up like neon dust. And he could have had that on his clothing. And imagine going in there with an alternate light source and you see these sparkles all over the place. And then you have them analyzed and you realize this relates back to a studio.
Does it make you wish in a way you could put this case out of your head, because you'll never have absolute confirmation that even your theory is correct?
No, I'll never have absolute confirmation. And if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't call the book Case Closed. I would leave that part off the title because it will never be closed. But no, I'm really glad I did it. I would not want to do it again. It was so intensive. I can't even tell you. 18 months I spent on that 22 trips to England, and then I went to France and all over the place chasing down documents and so forth. It was exhausting, but it's something that I feel very proud of, and I know that if people read the book, they'll have to at least think about what I'm saying because the science in it is really compelling.
Since you spend the better part of your workday sort of dwelling on these horrible, savage things that people can do to one another, I wonder if that makes it hard at the end of the day to just, you know, sit back and relax and do whatever else you do in your life.
You know, the truth is, even before I was interested in crime, I've never had much of an off switch. Mm-hmm. My mind just doesn't stop. And so, which is both good and bad.
Yeah.
When people say, what do you do to relax? I'm always, you know, I have to stumble around. Relax. Well, because flying the helicopter isn't really relaxing. Working out at the gym isn't really relaxing. I love to go for long walks, you know, and play with the dog. And I, of course, I have great time with Stacy. But I'm not much of a, you know, you never get me to just sit on a beach all day long. I go crazy.
And is it true you met your wife doing research for a book?
I met Stacy. Yeah, she's a neuroscientist on the faculty of Harvard's medical school, and she works at a psychiatric hospital. And when I was doing the research for Predator, I wanted to find the brightest people who are working with how the mind works, mm-hmm. and what might be different about it with different types of people, particularly ones with personality disorders, because psychopathy and sociopathy are basically personality disorders, character disorders, I call them. And so that's how I met her. I was assigned to her for the functional imaging with MRI. So we have a lot of fun. She's so smart, and we sit down and together, and we invent devices.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's this watch in the Scarpetta Factor. I think I called it a biograph. I can't really remember now what I called this watch. It's completely made up, and Stacy pretty much invented it. We were sitting. What if we had something that could do this and this and this? And then she starts. You know, she's just really, really bright, and so we make up stuff that could work. I said you should copyright it.
Does she read all along the whole process, or is there?
No.
Do you wait a few chapters, or how does that go?
No, I don't let anybody read it while I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. When I might let someone read the very beginning when I'm starting a book. I have a little tradition of my agent and maybe someone at the publishing house. I'll let them read the first 10 pages. If nothing else, so they know I've really – it makes them feel better that I've really started something. But once I'm into it, it's my secret thing. I don't show it to anybody.
And you don't strike me as a procrastinator, but you mentioned, you know, you have deadlines to think about. I mean, how do you pace the writing so you know you've got that 460 to 520 pages ready to go?
Well, again, you have to think of it as a relationship. It's because if it's a job, I don't think I could deal with the deadline because mm-hmm. I just don't have enough time. But if you have a really intense relationship with something or someone, you will find time to spend with that person or whatever it is because it's part of you. And so if I have an 8-hour day and six of it at home, I'm caught up doing other things and I only have 2 hours to myself, I'm still going to sit down with it for 2 hours because I want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I might just reread what I did and that's all I get to and maybe change two words of it. But it keeps it in my mind. It keeps the relationship alive so that when I really can then block off time, which is what I'll do as soon as this book tour is over, I will really have to isolate quite a lot for the next few months to get the 20th one written. And then I sometimes go away from home too and I'm just by myself for a while.
Yeah, so there's no distraction whatsoever.
No, I just live with it morning, noon, and night. That's what I have to do.
And in terms of what you are reading, obviously you do a lot of reading to be prepared for the books. Do you read anything just for fun or to put your brain in a different place?
Well, the things that I read for fun may not be so much fun for other people. Like right now, someone just recommended this, and I just picked up a copy of, I believe it's called Rawhide Down, which is about the attempted assassination of Reagan. And it's, you know, nonfiction, and it's really, really interesting. And so but I love things that are detailed. I love really good biographies, mm-hmm. Or something that shows me a picture of a world like Cleopatra,
yeah.
You know, which is a fantastic book. And now and then I'll read a novel if someone tells me it's really, really good. But you and I were talking about this earlier. If fiction's not really good, I just can't really get into it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's why I write the kind of fiction I do, because I want something that's not boring to me. And the detail makes it interesting.
Did you know from the time you were a kid that you wanted to be a writer in some capacity?
Well, no. When I was a little kid, I wanted to be an archaeologist. And mm-hmm. I was always digging up the yard and fishing in the, when I was panning for things in the creek thinking I was going to find buried treasure or something. And then I wanted to be a tennis player. So, and when I turned 19 and realized I was never going to be able to earn a living as a tennis player, I'd always been writing. And so I thought, well, yes, the only thing you seem to be kind of good at, maybe you should just focus on that. So I became an English major in college and just decided I was going to be a writer. It was a process of elimination for me. I just didn't think I was all that good at anything else, which is kind of strange. It wasn't that I thought this is what I would love to do. This is what I'm really was born to do. I just thought, you know what, you're kind of good at this. And when you read literature, you see things in it other people don't. So you probably have some kind of gift. And you don't seem all that gifted in chemistry after I dropped it in 3 days. And you can't do math because I was terrible in that.
But it's funny because both of those things figure heavily into the character you're writing.
I know. Scarpetta and Lucy do things effortlessly that I have to just really study.
This is her fabulous niece, by the way, for people who haven't.
Right. I mean, like those. Lucy, I mean, yes, I fly helicopters and I have my pilot's license. Did all my training right around here, as a matter of fact, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But I have to work pretty hard at some things that are technical. It's really fun to have women characters who are so effortless in their way of doing things that I have to study a little bit. So, I can write really well about an autopsy, but you wouldn't want me to do one.
I think what I love best about your story and how you got started is you admitting that you wrote what you call, I haven't seen them, 4 bad novels before you could write good ones. What kept you going after you did 2 and thought, I don't know, this didn't work?
It was a survival instinct. I really believed that this was the only thing I could do in life. I know this sounds so strange to say, but I believed I had one song I could sing. And if I couldn't sing that song, I thought I was going to be a total failure. And I'd already failed at tennis, which broke my heart. And, I mean, really, truly, I went into a massive decline when I got beaten by a 12-year-old when I was 19. And I realized, you will never make it. You're not going to be your hero, Billie Jean King, ever. And so I was just dismantled by my disappointment because that was my dream. And I couldn't have tried harder than I did at it. And so when I started getting these early books rejected, I felt it was all happening to me all over again. I said, you are destined for failure. I thought, you get this close, and then it just all vanishes on you. And I say this with all honesty because I remind people, don't give up. Don't give up. 100 million copies later, I'm sitting here. And I thought my life was over. After the 3rd Scarpetta crime novel was rejected, I was just devastated, and I thought I should just quit. And then somebody encouraged me to try one more, and they said, make Scarpetta the main character. She's the best one. And write about what you see at the morgue. Don't write about all these buried treasure and people who wrote things into their wills and the fancy motives for why people are killed. And so I wrote Postmortem. And then that got rejected by everybody. And I was really thinking of quitting, but I just never quit because it's all I could do.
Patricia Cornwell's newest novel is called Red Mist. She will be signing books tonight at the Barnes & Noble store on Northwest Highway in Dallas. That starts at 7 o'clock. Patricia, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.